Remakers Mark, Episode 7, The Breakfast Club. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to part two of our discussion of The Breakfast Club here at Remakers Mark, Episode 7. With me, as always, is my friend Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Great, good to hear. And Jeremy Nilsson, how are you doing?
Fantastic.
Great. Lee Horsepower, how are you tonight?
Just dandy.
Excellent. And Mark Josting, how are you?
Cloud Nine, thank you.
Wait, what?
Cloud Nine, damn it.
Cloud Nine, I'm sorry. I thought you said something in Gaelic. It's like, did my babblefish go? What's going on here? Something's not right. Well, I'm happy you're on Cloud Nine. That's good to hear. Again, this is part two of our discussion of The Breakfast Club. Thus far, we've discussed recasting decisions, which we'll touch on a little bit. And coming up here, we're going to be talking about plot, tech, and filmmaking changes that we would make to the remake as well. Before we do so, I want to thank our friends at Tipsy Pixels for their promotional consideration. Tipsy Pixels is a retro video game contest held at the Triple Rock Social Club in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's hosted by Nels Lenz of Huge Theater. The next event is on Sunday, May 12th at a new time, with doors and casual gaming starting at 6 and the tourney starting at 7. The game featured at that date will be Mario Kart 64, once again, an old favorite. This also features drink specials from Tallgrass Brewing, and players can win retro games and systems from Level Up Games, as well as free show tickets from the Triple Rock and free drinks. To find out more information, hit them up at tipsypixels.com or find them on Twitter at twitter.com/tipsypixels. Also, I want to touch on some feedback that we got from people on Twitter. I put out a call to see if anyone had suggestions for who they might recast in a remake of The Breakfast Club. A friend of the show, Amber Carter, Amber Color Life on Twitter, suggested Michael Cera as Brian, Emma Stone as Claire, Josh Hutcherson as Andrew, Ari Gaynor as Allison, James Franco as Bender, and then my personal favorite, Alec Baldwin as Assistant Principal Dick. I think that one's fantastic. I really like Josh Hutcherson as well. I almost picked him as Andrew. That was very close.
I almost did too.
Yep, that was very, very close for me.
I thought about Michael Cera, but he's wearing thin with me.
Interesting.
He seemed too obvious.
Well, way to pick on our fans, guys. Nice. I'm sure Amber will be listening lots.
But thanks for listening.
Oh, she's forgiving folk. It'll be fine. Also, Josh Freeman, who has participated a lot in the show, which we very much appreciate. He's at jfreeman159 on Twitter. Suggested Channing Tatum as the jock, Emma Stone as the princess, Selma Blair as the kook, which I thought was a great choice.
Ooh, yeah, I like that.
Nicholas Holt as the brain, and Dave Franco as the criminal. And then finally, my cousin Steve Grotham, who is at Gleeb on Twitter, G-L-E-E-B, did a little bit of guesswork and suggested Judd Nelson as the wise janitor. So I think, Lee, that was your pick, was it not?
Excellent. Yes, it was. Yes,
premonition.
Indeed. He was on your wavelength. So thank you all for participating. Again, if you want to find us, you can do so at mathishard.net or on twitter.com/mathishardnet or facebook.com/mathishardnet as well. Hit us up there and let us know what you think. So now, before we dive into the plot, tech, and filmmaking changes we would make to The Breakfast Club, we want to touch on our recasting choices and what choices we made, and then ultimately, who was the big winner amongst our participants here, and then what our next movie is. So I'll just run down the line of the original roles and who we chose to recast it. Richard Vernon, originally played by Paul Gleason. We chose my choice of Paul Giamatti. The role of Allison Reynolds, originally played by Ally Sheedy. We chose Andy's role of Alia Shawcott. In the role of Brian Johnson, originally played by Anthony Michael Hall, Jer and Lee both chose Christopher Mintz-Plasse. In the role of Andrew Clark, originally played by Emilio Estevez, we went with Mark's choice of Aaron Taylor Johnson. In the role of Claire Standish, originally played by Molly Ringwald, we went with Lee's choice of Ellie Kemper. And finally, in the role of John Bender, originally played by Judd Nelson, we chose Kyle and Mark's choice of Paul Dano. So if you add those up there, in addition to the minor character choice, which Mark won in addition for the big tiebreaker, Mark, once again, 2 weeks in a row, is the big winner. Congratulations, Mark. Well done.
Thank you.
Well done. Very good. So do you want to tell us what our next film will be, please?
Indeed I do. To get us more in touch with our theatrical side, we are going to talk about the movie My Fair Lady.
Very good. Shall we enunciate greatly in doing so?
Whatever.
Sort of a rain in Spain thing.
good answer. Whatever.
And we'll let Kyle then explain in that episode how this movie relates to The Last Starfighter.
Well, this has been Andy's last version. Oh, I already made that joke, but that's fine.
But not with the bang. But yeah, not with the bang. Okay.
I got my old sing song talky actors mixed up. So it happens, okay? It happens to a lot of guys. So I'm excited about My Fair Lady. I think that'll be a lot of fun, and that'll be a good one. So good choice, Mark. I'm excited for that. So
thank you.
Congratulations and well picked. All right, so let's move on to our discussion of The Breakfast Club and how we would change things on the filmmaking side of things. What plot holes would we change? Would technology change things? How would it be updated if made today in terms of people, in terms of setting, in terms of lots of things? So the first thing that came to mind to us was kind of at the heart of the movie, which is much of what the movie consists of is based upon the stereotypes that these teenagers in this movie represent. So in the original, you had the, you know, as we've discussed, you had the athlete, you had the thief / burnout, you had the pretty princess kind of, you had the artsy one, and you had the nerd. So, you know, that might have been indicative of Chicago area in 1985. Is that still representative of what stereotypes could be today? You know, is that something that a lot of those are universal and will always be the case in terms of people that we would want represented in our remake, or are some things that we'd want to change a little bit? So I think that would be a really fun discussion. Does anybody want to start that off with some thoughts that they have about that?
Well, I think that The reason that this movie works so well is that those are pretty much universal stereotypes or universal cliques, I think is probably a better word for it, of high school life. You're always going to have the athletic jockey clique. You're always going to have the kind of the rulers of the school, the rich popular kids and that kind of thing. I think if you're going to look at what different cliques you could put in there now, the only two that really come to mind that seem to be getting a lot more play in movies and being more cliche these days are kind of that sort of stoner group where you're just kind of a burnout, but in a different way. It seems to be with a lot of the cheerleading movies that there's like 900 of them.
Bring it on.
Bring it on and bring it on two and bring it on
900.
Bring it on more honor and like whatever they kind of play into the whole like cheerleader and then sort of more of the kind of like catty, slutty vibe too on the other end of it. And then they become friends and they realize that being slutty and being a cheerleader both have one thing in common, and that's dance. But I digress. But yeah, I think that the reason the movie works is because these are kind of universal cliques of high school, and they haven't changed that much.
I think that Glee takes on a lot of the newer twists of the high school clique, kind of finding the common thread in song and dance. But they have the gay kids. They have the physically disabled kids. They have, they speak very openly about the fat kids, things that I don't think were maybe as openly discussed in the 80s. But there's always going to be the popular kids. Like you said, Jared, they seem to be more portrayed now as like the cheerleaders, although maybe that's just because it's easily recognizable. Like I was thinking, for example, for Ally Sheedy's portrayal of Allison Reynolds as like the basket case, where now I think that would be taken a lot more seriously, or that could be portrayed as like the over medicated kid who is a little bit numb, you know? So that would be an interesting, not necessarily the stoner kid, but just, you know, too many psych meds and kind of detached from reality now a little bit. So I don't know, something to chew on.
I could add a realm of not danger, but anytime there's uncertainty, I think that that's touched on a little bit in the original in terms of like, why is she here? You know, it's never really clear. And then ultimately it just reveals that she just wants to be there. Like there's no real reason for her to be there. But I think if it could be played
or
up.
Or was that a lie? Sorry.
Could be.
She was a pathological liar.
It's true. So, you know, I think that could be if you sense a risk there or, you know, when they're really at each other's throats at the beginning, I think you could pull that up a little bit and make that even more uncertain and have her be even more inconsistent and even more a little bit more aggravating, I guess that could be. And, you know, we don't want to go so far as to make anybody seem really, really wacko, I guess, but maybe just a little bit more wacko, not totally wacko. On the whackometer, somewhere in the upper regions.
But I think being a little more wacko is more accepted today, and it wouldn't be seen as maybe as provocative, you know, that they could be portrayed as a little more wacko, and that would be okay. It may not be portrayed as being an antagonistic technique. You know what I mean?
Well, and I think Ally Sheedy's character in the 80s version of high school and cliques and that sort of thing. She was kind of a hodgepodge of a lot of different things. The artsy student, the sort of loner, do what I want kind of person. And you know, they may have sort of talked about this whole, like, she's crazy, but they didn't really flesh that out at all. And not that, you know, whatever, you know, not that depression equals crazy or anything like that. But I think that if you were to remake this today, the character could be much more focused on somebody that's got whatever it might be this is somebody dealing with depression or with, you know, borderline personality or something like that. And that it becomes a little bit more serious, but it's also, I mean, that's something that kids today are dealing with in a fairly serious manner. And I think that character dealing with those issues and becoming, and having that being the thing that everybody sort of realizes that, oh, you're just like the rest of us. We're all still human. We all can get along and understand and relate to each other. I think that would play a lot more to what high schoolers are dealing with now than this person that's sort of ambiguous in what their weirdness is. Like Ally Sheedy's character was.
Yeah, just to name it and be a little more specific and give it some substance. Yeah.
I think there's also less of a thing these days as that would be like the social fringes, you know, rather than the fringes of mental health.
Yeah.
But I think Ally Sheedy's character was supposed to be just more out there socially. And yeah, I mean, they mentioned a couple things with her, you know, with her general wellness. They, you know, she calls herself a pathological liar. You know, other than that, they really were pretty vague about it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's the kind of mysterious character that was portrayed in that role probably wouldn't intimidate the modern teenager as much.
But I agree.
Giving an actual problem that they're dealing with would be more effective.
I think it's interesting, you know, I don't know the history of school shootings much, like around the mid 80s. I don't know how that was back then, but, you know, the fact that they chose to give the nerd the gun, you know, I mean, that he was the one who brought that to school. Like were this movie to not exist, and we made this basically the same movie today, it would be assumed that, like, either probably the Judd Nelson character or the Ally Sheedy character be the one that brought the gun in, right? Just kind of based on how that stereotype tended to be. So was his choice to have the nerd there because he brought the gun in, was that informed by the thinking that that was the case? Or it would be really interesting to hear what the reasoning was behind that. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want to change that in a remake today, even though it would make more sense in terms of today's kind of how things have been in that way, that to have the nerd not have it necessarily. But I think it's a nice, I don't want to say a nice touch, but I think that's a good choice for who would have that or for that reason for him for being there.
I think you keep that in there specifically because it goes against what people would expect. And that fighting against the stereotype is really what is one of kind of the, what's at the heart of this movie, is that we aren't the labels that we give each other or that have been given to us. And I think that, you know, if we write it to play into what those labels are, then, I mean, that's kind of defeating the purpose. So giving the nerd, like you said, giving the nerd the gun, which I think is a funny way to put it, but you know, doing that goes against both labels, you know, both the who brings a gun to school and what, you know, what nerds do.
Yep.
And nerds definitely just do math, don't they?
Exactly.
Math and science.
Yep. STEM. That's all they do.
Math is hard.
Well,
math
is hard. And Star Wars. .net.
And Star Wars. So in other words, us. Great. So, Andy, you brought up a good point here that the original Breakfast Club is about the problems that suburban white kids faced in the 80s. What if it was remade in a different socioeconomic or racial environment or background? Do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. We hit on it a little bit in the point we were just making, talking about what stereotypes would exist and are there truly universal stereotypes. And I think we would be challenged to find universal stereotypes that would fit across different socioeconomic and racial mixes in different schools. There would probably be some, you know, the popular kid, sure. Things like, you know, I'm sure you could probably find a nerd of some variety in just about every school. But there's a lot of different issues that I think would come up that aren't even, that don't come close to being addressed in the Breakfast Club. My wife used to be a teacher in a school district that had a very diverse racial population and had a lot of immigrant students that had just arrived from, you know, various African countries, various Southeast Asian countries, kids that, you know, had only been in the United States for 3 weeks and now they're trying to be assimilated into an American junior high. That is an entire genre or category of student that isn't considered. So like just something like that would be an interesting thought exercise to figure out how this movie would play out in a really poor rural school district or a really racially diverse inner city school district or something like that. What do you guys think?
I think that the stereotypes would probably just fall along racial lines.
How do you mean?
I mean that there would be a tendency just to cast as racially diverse as possible.
So instead of it being the nerd and the popular kid and the burnout, it would be the white kid, the black kid, the Hispanic kid, the Asian kid.
Yeah, I think
something like that.
I think there would be a temptation for Hollywood to do that.
I could see that. That's interesting. I mean, I haven't watched Glee. Does Glee go quite in that direction in there? You know, you touched a little bit on how they approach that, but would you put it under that sort of categorization, or is that part of it?
I don't want to sound like the resident Glee expert here, because I've only
seen. Don't deny
that. That's okay. All right. My wife and I did watch the first season. I will admit to that. And they address the racial categorization a little bit tongue in cheek. You know, the cheerleaders are, well, I guess they're not all white, but they're most of them are white. I don't know. Maybe not, but I mean, that's a racially diverse cast, but I don't know if they categorize them so much in along racial lines, if that makes sense. It's kind of there, but I don't think it's overt.
Yeah, I think to something like Mean Girls, where that categorization was hugely in place, and that was done in a much more satirical, biting way, but it was like the Asians were all together, the super popular people were all together, the like D&D kids were all together. So I think that's a more of an example of that type of categorization, but I don't think it pretended to be any kind of commentary other than just a comedic view of how high school can be or probably is. I don't know. I mean, I thank God I'm not in high school anymore, so I can't really say to it, but yeah, that's interesting.
But if you go that in those lines, and I think definitely that does exist, that cliques or groups are formed along those lines, as well as through some of the stereotypes that we've talked about. But if you kind of assume that and look at it that way, and you take one person from each of those groups and put them in detention together, you don't really have anything identifying them beyond race at that point. What are they? I mean, I guess they could learn a lesson that's more of a racially defined, you know, we're all the same that way. But it really doesn't talk to the same theme that the original Breakfast Club is, which is, you know, regardless of where we come from, what groups we hang out with, we all still have similarities and we can relate to each other, and which is still the same if it's, you know, race based instead of click based. But I think if you take an individual out of a group that way, without sort of that cliche defining characteristic, jock, you know, brain, whatever those things are, I think that it gets a little bit more murky.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. So another thing that we touched on is kind of the role of punishment and detention in the original movie and in today's world. So Lee, you made a point about the fact that with school violence at the level that it has been in the last, you know, certainly since this movie came out, but especially in the last 10, 15 years, would something of that nature be dealt with much more strictly? Or, I mean, would we essentially have to tone down what he did, what Brian did? I mean, if we basically did verbatim what they said that he did, I think it would probably be much more than detention for that. So do you want to touch on that a little bit?
He would have been arrested and that would have been the end of it.
Right.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, yeah, and I was wondering about that, you know, if remaking this, you know, in modern day, you know, how would we address that? Because yeah, it wouldn't be detention. He would be in jail or he would be expelled somehow.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how good his grades were.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's I believe a no tolerance policy that most schools have on that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure at the school where I taught, the disciplinary action for bringing a gun to school, you know, flare or no, was automatic expulsion.
Yep.
It would. Charlie, go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, you know, so how do we address that in a remake, or do we just give him, you know, a different transgression that lands him in detention?
I think you'd have to, because if you wanted to go along the lines of he's suicidal but didn't necessarily bring a gun, let's just say he mentioned to somebody that he was suicidal, you know, he was thinking of killing himself, that wouldn't land him in detention. That would land him in, you know, serious counseling, and if they had a school psychologist or something like that, it would land him in a crisis intervention center.
Right.
Wouldn't land him in a detention, you know, setting like this. So I think you'd have to come up with some entirely new crime that he would commit, like he cheated on, you know, he has been getting his good grades because he's been cheating this whole time or something right. like that.
Or he's selling the answers to
Ooh, that's tests. A good one. He's been selling them to the burnout.
At the very least, you have to make their actions more consistent. Yeah, maybe in 1985, the punishment for bringing a flare gun to school would be the same as pulling the fire alarm, but you know, definitely not today. We really could set a remake in juvie, and their punishments would be that severe. It would be, you know, I brought a gun to school. I beat a kid so badly he was in the hospital for a week.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Yep.
Or if it's a lighter punishment, maybe they are in detention in school. Then okay, yeah, I pulled the fire alarm. Yeah, I cheated on a test. I poured something not pleasant in the teacher's coffee. I don't know.
You rogue. What was Claire's crime? I can't think of it right now.
She skipped
school. Oh.
Yeah.
Boo, that's dumb.
Which seems like an entire Saturday of detention seems pretty severe for something like that.
Yeah, even in 1985.
Yeah.
I think these days you skip school and... and it just counts against your attendance record.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
In my high school, it was for every hour that you skipped, you got 2 hours of detention. So I don't know. Maybe this would, if she skipped half a day, then that would be a whole day of detention. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Wow. I totally don't remember what the detention rules were in my high school. I have no idea. So that's the other part is like, is detention still around? I mean, Mark and Andy, you've both taught some and you've had, you know, presence in schools. I work at a college, so we don't really have detention. I mean, we're more in the, you know, arrest or no arrest kind of realm, I guess. I mean, there's certainly punishment, but it's not, you know, it's not detention per se. So I don't, what
I think a music school should have detention. they should have to listen to Starship or something like that.
Without this city.
You just get locked in an elevator for a while.
Yeah, that's how we break them. Man.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember having like in-school suspension, which was, I believe, an after school detention sort of thing. It was a couple hours with, oh, the guy that was in charge of it was just a monster. But I never had any recollection of an all day Saturday kind of a thing. It seems to me logistically like kind of a nightmare. Like first of all, the fact that they got locked into this giant, pretty cool looking library kind of a space is one thing. Like I would have expected them to be shut in an empty classroom.
Yeah.
Nothing in it except a ticking clock.
But however were they to study, Andy?
But I would think you needed, you know, more than just the one assistant principal to watch. Like logistically, it just seems like it would be such a headache for the school. They wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Saturday detention isn't a thing that's really done. And it's because you do need to bring in extra staff to maintain the security. And apparently the school in this film wasn't concerned about security. But you know, also
Carl handles everything.
Also, the schools are concerned that, you know, on the weekends, you know, kids have jobs and they need to actually support their families. And so Saturday isn't something that you take away from a high schooler anymore.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Detention is kind of controversial, but suspension is definitely the thing that's more realistic. And a remake of this film could be set in an in-school suspension, which actually I think it would be really entertaining if we work in the element of, the rest of the school is full of teenagers at that time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, interesting. I like that. So can you say a little bit more about that?
The debate about detention and suspension is, there are a lot of facets and, you know, ins and outs and what have yous, but, it's a tough thing to keep a kid in school when they could possibly be helping their family, working, you know, doing something like that. With suspensions, do you just keep the kid out of school because they're a troublemaker? Well, that was their point in the whole play, in the first place. They don't want to be in school. So in school suspensions, well, then what do? You dedicate a staff member to watching this one kid while they do nothing. That being said, keeping a group of kids in an empty classroom for a while probably is the safest answer for most schools. Honestly, I don't know how this would happen, but if the teacher happens to leave the room for a while, then all sorts of chaos could ensue. Yeah, the teacher really wouldn't leave the room, so I guess I don't know how that would happen.
Well, Dick was not the best teacher. Put it that way.
No, I wasn't.
Interesting. Yeah, I like the idea of changing it where there's all this action going on around, because then it's like they're really, really missing out, because you never get a sense of that. I mean, you know, you have Claire at the beginning saying, can't you get me out of this? So they don't want to be there, but they don't give a sense of like what they're missing out on, really.
They talk a little bit about that party later that night, but it's not a big plot point.
Right, right. Yeah.
But there's no sporting event happening, or there's no, yeah. I hear what you're saying.
There's no formal dance.
You mean the sock hop was canceled?
So yeah, having so much energy and effort all around them would be pretty interesting. I like that idea.
Yeah, I think even just in the soundscapes, if you have those familiar school sounds, there's a bell ringing and there's all this clamoring and hullabaloo in the hallway, lockers being slammed and cowbells ringing and chickens crowing. And
not to mention the potential hijinks of trying to get other people involved. It's rife with potential there, I tell you what.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus, think of all the extra minor characters you could now add.
That's true. It's no longer just Carl. Oh, Carl. So, Jerry, you brought an interesting point about this, that this concept has been, we'll say, copied, redone, parodied, overused a lot since then. So you kind of came up with an idea about what a remake could be. That is very true to the original vision, almost, identically so, or, what's the word? Exactly the same. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, since I would imagine that Breakfast Club is not the original, but this whole idea of bringing five or, you know, X number of people from different places, different backgrounds, different social or, you know, whatever strata together, and then they, you know, are forced to be in this place together and then ultimately learn that they're all the same or whatever.
Usual suspects.
To a degree. I mean, they don't really come to find out that they all, you know, are friends or whatever.
They don't fall in love.
Can we redo that one?
The usual club.
But especially as far as it relates to the issues that teens are dealing with, there's been a lot of very similar styled movies. Even the I can't think of it now, the Freddie Prinze Jr. movie.
She's
All That.
Can't Hardly Wait. One?
With Rachel Lee Cook?
Maybe. I don't remember.
Big dancing at the end, yeah.
Possibly. I haven't watched it in a long time. But, there's been other similar movies that deal with the sort of different social strata of high school. And even Mean Girls kind of deals with it to a certain point. And then it's even the Breakfast Club itself has even been mimicked or mocked with Not Another Teen Movie, another movie similar to that, where it's very much just that whole thing just played out again, which Molly Ringwald was in. Mm-hmm. So I think if we were to remake The Breakfast Club, and also I also want to point out there's a movie coming out later this year that is rumored to be a remake of Breakfast Club, even though it's really not. It's called Bumped, and it's about 5 20-somethings that all get bumped from a flight, and they have to spend, you know, X amount of time in the airport together, and, you know, now they're stuck in the same place and they're forced to get to know each other and wah wah. But it's not a remake because it has, you know, it's besides that very skeleton idea, it's really not anything like Breakfast Club. It's not school, it's not detention, it's not high school students, it's completely different. So, but you've even got that kind of thing going on. So I think if there was going to be a remake of Breakfast Club, I would love to see it set in the 80s, with 80s mentality, 80s stereotypes, 80s cliques, and really remake it as close to the original as possible in its theme and focus. That's my two cents.
So basically just do an homage kind of remake sort of thing. So have it be very similar. Same outfit, same fashion, same characters, the whole nine yards.
Oh, maybe. I mean, you could certainly flesh out the characters in a little bit different way or, you know, make them a little bit more well-rounded. I think that looking back on, especially like Anthony Michael Hall's character and like we've already talked about Ally Sheedy a little bit, but all the characters really kind of are very paper thin as far as, you know, how you would describe them. I mean, they're pretty much, you know, one note song. And I think some of that's on purpose and some of that is probably just from a, let's keep this as simple as possible. And so I would love to see them more well-rounded characters that ultimately when they get into the end, the ending act, that then it would make more sense that, they're friends or they've come to a greater understanding of each other or whatever.
Yeah. That's an interesting idea. I like that. Plus, we could just keep using that. Oh God, who sang that song? Simple Minds? No,
Simple Minds.
Yeah. Was it Simple Minds? Yep, yep. We didn't talk about the music at all. That's too bad. I guess there was only a couple of musical cues, but man, that is really the definitive 80s movie, like teenage movie song. Don't You Forget About Me. So good. Mm-hmm. It's not quite Top Gun level goodness, but it's pretty darn good.
It's a different goodness.
It's just a different goodness. Exactly. So another thing we talked about was a feature that we've done sometimes called Been There, Done That, which is talking about movies that are similar to this one or were inspired by this, and so about or featuring teenagers. So we've talked about a couple, She's All That. Jer, I thought for a while there you were going to be speaking ill of Bring It On, at least the original, and I was not going to have any of that.
I would never speak ill of Bring It On, nor any of its dozen or so sequels.
Okay. Well, sequels you can have at. I've not seen any of those, but the original, that's just fantastic. I mean, just the toothbrush scene alone is so good. Anyways, I digress. So you know, maybe Bring It On is in there. So Lee, you had a few that you kind of came up with as you were compiling these as well. Do you want to touch on some of those, and anybody else want to chip in when he's done as well?
Yeah. Well, I think the Breakfast Club at its core is a coming of age movie. And, you know, I was thinking of Diner, is very much a coming of age movie. Super Bad, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, another John Hughes gem. St. Elmo's Fire, The Legend of Billie Jean, and I thought of another one that was produced by John Hughes but not directed by John Hughes, and that was Some Kind of Wonderful, which is one of my favorites. But yeah, there have been a lot of coming of age movies, I think, that came after The Breakfast Club. I think maybe American Graffiti was sort of the one that started that whole genre. But yeah, this is, I think that it's a really good genre because everyone can relate to it.
I think The Breakfast Club is kind of maybe the archetype of this genre.
Could
in a certain sense that a lot of these other movies, not necessarily aspire to be, but base what they're doing, kind of use The Breakfast Club as a reference point to jump off in whatever direction they want to choose. Another movie that popped into my head when you were listing off your movies, Lee, was one that we've already discussed a couple times in this episode. The Perks of Being a Wallflower, I think, is a more recent take on the coming of age story, kind of in that same genre.
I still need to see that.
It's quite good.
Yeah, ditto.
It's very good. And I think addresses all the social issues that The Breakfast Club wants to talk about in a more frank way.
Yeah, I would agree to that.
So just more modern in that way? It's a bit more open, a bit more available to discuss those sort of things?
It's a little darker in its subject material. Maybe that's not the right word, but it more honest and real.
Yeah, and a little bit more serious about about what can happen when there are social conflicts.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah, I know very little about it. I watched the trailer months ago, but never looked into it further. So I'll definitely check that out.
The book is excellent.
Oh, okay, good to know.
But this is not a book podcast.
No, heck no. None of that crap. So the last thing that we wanted to talk about was just the fact that the Brat Pack existed back then. So, I mean, this was a very different, unique thing. This group of young actors and actresses who were really talented and really potent and were like box office gold for a really long time. So we're talking about, you know, Rob Lowe, Demi Moore, Emilio Estevez, Molly Ringwald, Ally Sheedy, Anthony Michael Hall, Robert Downey Jr., I think, was in there too. I mean, I don't know how far out it reaches.
Andrew McCarthy, was he part of that?
Yep.
Charlie Sheen, I believe.
So, I mean, there's all this group of young actors that all kind of came of age, as it were, in Hollywood at that time. And I'm wondering, has there been a case of that either since then or especially now? Can you guys think of like a Brat Pack today? You know, we've had some mention of like the Disney World, and I think that's pretty close in terms of, you know, potency, in terms of star power, but I think that's more manufactured. I wasn't old enough to know if these people were being manufactured or not, but it certainly didn't feel that way, and it doesn't feel that way in the movies that they're in. You know, none of it feels forced. I mean, they're not all the greatest movies, but it's not like Hannah Montana, where it's this, you know, what was the Hillary Duff one?
Lizzie McGuire.
Yep. So, I mean, it's not these like universes that are basically, you know, created to sell a person, sell a market, and sell a bunch of toys. Like these were actors and actresses first and foremost, who then built careers out of roles, not a universe underneath them. So I don't know. I mean, can you guys think of anything? Nothing came to mind to me, but I'm wondering if you guys had any thoughts.
You know, I think, what's at the core of this, the Brat Pack phenomenon is just that you had a group of actors that really liked working with each other, or at least some producer liked them working with each other. I think that we do have a very similar thing today. You know, I wouldn't call them a Brat Pack just because they're older, but, you know, if you look at your like Paul Rudd, Seth Rogen, Leslie Mann, who else can we toss in there? But,
I can add on to your discourse. Mark,
please do.
I'm losing my words. What you're describing and the Brat Pack name came from the Rat Pack, which is, you know, the actors that all played in the same movies all together back in the much earlier times with Frank Sinatra and
Tony Bennett,
Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. and Tony. Yeah, that was the Rat Pack. And then the 80s came and there was this Brat Pack. And now, what we have, and I think they're probably kind of getting to the farther end of their, not their careers, but their popularity, maybe that's not the right word either, but what Hollywood has referred to as the Frat Pack.
Ah.
And that is, it was originally, Vince Vaughn, Will Ferrell.
Oh yeah.
The Owen and,
oh, sure.
The Owen Wilson brothers. And yep. Luke Wilson. And then it has, kind of, added in to some of these other minor things like Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen and Ben Stiller and right. some of those other ones. So you've got the same kind of idea of just this group of people that all end up starring in each other's or, you know, cameoing in each other's movies, which I think is kind of a pretty similar concept. It's certainly not young actors and actresses, but yeah, you've got the Rat Pack to the Brat Pack to now the Frat Pack. Clever, clever. Yeah, entertainment writers must be paid a lot of money.
I can't wait for the cheeky British equivalent, just called the Drat Pack. Just very, very, very dry, like the Cumberbatches and Freemans of the world. That'll be the Drat Pack.
And then sticking around to Britain, there'll be the Pratt Pack, and they're all just dicks.
Oh. Wow.
I remember, I think it was like 1999 or something like that, I saw an article in Entertainment Weekly or something like that. I can't remember which one, but they had this whole list of like 100 actors and actresses, that were under 30 and were working at the time. And they just had their picture, their name, and sort of like a quick phrase of like this, like the typical character that they played. You know, it was like Reese Witherspoon was the likable girl who's constantly stepped on, and Christina Ricci is the goth chick, and you know, they just kind of went down the line. So you know, I didn't get a sense of there being any sort of like new Brat Pack or anything like that, but it was kind of interesting to see this entire list of actors that were popular at the time and sort of what they are known for.
It'd also be interesting to see now that there are there are so many more movies that give much more prevalent roles to young actors and actresses, like the Harry Potters of the world, the Hunger Games of the world. You know, I mean, there's young adult literature is so much more legitimate, and movies are being made of that. So you're going to see people like, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, like you saw him when you were 9, and you're going to see him for the next 40 years. So it's like you've seen him grow, and it's now the opportunity for younger and actors and actresses to have that much more presence, and to not only have presence, but to have built presence. And I think so much of that was with the Brat Pack, is like, they didn't just come in at 20. Like, a lot of them had been acting for a while before then, not to the level that they were at kind of at their peak, certainly, but they came to there, you know what I mean? So I think we could see a bit of a resurgence in that. I mean, just, you know, the number of teenage roles and teenage actors and actresses that are out there now is seemingly hugely larger than at least I remember in any time, really. And a hush comes over the crowd.
You just blew my mind.
Yeah. So before go ahead, Jer.
I would point out that most of the Brat Pack, when they were in their popularity, were in their early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this... Yeah, we have, and I think there's a lot of people that, like you say, the Daniel Radcliffe's and the, a lot of the people that we picked for the roles today, they're the same. They're mid to early 20s. They're up and coming, but they're certainly not, you know, 16.
Unless you're Jaden Smith.
Right.
Except for Jaden Smith.
That's right. You go, Jaden. I'm really excited for After Earth. I'm just gonna throw that out there. All right. So before we finish up here, we just wanted to just do kind of a round robin here to each of us and say, what character from the original Breakfast Club did you most relate to when you first watched it? And has that changed since you've watched it? So how would it be now? So we'll go alphabetical again. So Andy, do you want to start us off? Who did you relate to when you first watched it? And who do you most relate to now?
Brian Johnson and Brian Johnson.
Interesting. Do you want to expound upon that at all, Captain Verbose?
Brevity. I was a big nerd in elementary school before I realized what nerdery was and the negative connotations that were associated with it. And once I found that out, I spent the rest of my social life trying not to be a nerd, but knew deep down inside that's where my heart lie and still is.
Yep. I hear you there.
And I'm also terrible at shop class.
He broke an elephant clock too. Jeremy, how about you?
I would say in remembering what I used to think about when I watched movies, and I remember relating most probably to the Ally Sheedy character, largely because I didn't really have much of a social circle that I really couldn't put myself into any one of the categories. Not that I was, you know, above them or, you know, didn't believe in them or whatever. I just kind of was more on the fringes of things than involved in any one thing. So I'd say that's probably the one that I remember the first few times that I watched that, the one that I'm like, yeah, I get it. Although I'm certainly not good at making sandwiches out of corn pops or whatever that was.
Captain Crunch.
Captain Crunch. Captain Crunch and Bologna.
And Pixie Sticks.
Yep. That was the topper for me, man. The Pixie Sticks was, that really did it for me. I was like, you know what? I'm intrigued, but now I want to eat that with the Pixie Sticks.
Oh, jeez. Yep.
I can't do it. And now I'd say I probably most relate to Carl the Janitor. Is that allowed?
Ooh, sure. That works for me.
It's the blackmail, isn't it?
It's all about the blackmail.
It's the blackmail and the... This is what my life has become, and I'm going to make the most of it by giving advice and blackmailing.
There we go. All right, so I'll go next. I would say originally the one that I most related to was Brian Johnson as well, was the nerd. Largely because, not because I was a nerd, even though I totally was, but largely because of the naivety of it. You know, I think that... I wanted to root for him because I kind of wanted myself to succeed in that same way, you know? And so that was sort of where that came from. And now when I was watching it now, it was less thinking about how it relates to me and more how it relates to the people around me. So again, I work at a music college in St. Paul. And, so I was thinking about like, who in my spheres of students that I work with, like who is Bender, who is Brian Johnson, and like thinking about that. And it was interesting thinking about like, as a music school, you know, an art-based school, like, you know, are more people tending to be like the Ally Sheedy type of character? And I don't think they really were. I mean, I think there's still a balance of that, which I was very happy to kind of reflect upon that a little bit. So I'd say a little bit the Ally Sheedy, but overall, it was just interesting to see how it can encapsulate many people, even today. So again, going to the universality of those stereotypes. So Lee, how about you?
Well, I think back then it was somewhere between Andrew the athlete and the Ally Sheedy character, just because I was very much into the sports that I was doing. I did three sports a year and was very dedicated to that, but I was also a little more reclusive than most of my friends, I guess. Now, if I had to pick one, it would be maybe a little bit more like John Bender, just because as the older I get, the less and less I care about what people think. So that's
nice.
Yeah.
A little anarchist in Lee.
Yeah, a little bit.
I like it. No petty theft, though, usually.
No, not
just,
at all.
Just grand larceny for the most part.
And I don't hide marijuana in my locker.
Smart. Good move. All right. And finally, Mark, how about you?
Well, when I was high school age, it certainly would have been the Allison Reynolds character, just for being, you know, weird and artsy and striving to be misunderstood and not really belonging to a particular clique. You know, these days, you know, probably the principal, sorry, assistant principal.
So you're a dick.
Yeah. And you mess with the bull, you get the horns.
It's true. You are a disciplinarian, if ever I've met one.
And you usually have toilet seat covers hanging out of the back of your pants.
Usually, yes.
On purpose.
Usually, yes.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. That was a grand time, as always. So that wraps up the second half of our discussion of The Breakfast Club. And just to remind you, we have our website at mathishard.net if you want to hit us up and let us know what we're doing well or not well, or just provide feedback on character choices that you would do differently, or plot or filmmaking changes that you would do differently or pick differently. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at twitter.com/mathishardnet and facebook.com/mathishardnet. The next episode will be released on May 20th, where we will be discussing My Fair Lady. So very much looking forward to that. Gentlemen, as always, thanks much for your great picks and discussion. This is a grand time, and we'll see you again shortly, and may the Force be with you.
And also with you.